Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. For the past seven decades, Tim Matheson has been an on-screen favorite in Hollywood. In his new memoir, Damn Glad to Meet You, My Seven Decades in the Hollywood Trenches, he looks behind the scenes of his career and reveals what it was like to learn from and work alongside the greats, including Lucille Ball, Dick Van Dyke, Steven Spielberg, and Aaron Sorkin. He also writes about how he transitioned from acting to directing, the role in The West Wing that nabbed him two Emmy nominations, and much more. Tim Matheson is a two-time Primetime Emmy Award-nominated actor and director who has dedicated his career to show business. He's best known for roles in Animal House, The West Wing, Magnum Force, Fletch, and Virgin River, among many others. It is a great pleasure to welcome Tim Matheson to this week's book show. Sir, what a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being here.
Hey, thank you, Joe. Thanks for having me on, and I appreciate the intro.
Well, the book is so much fun and really interesting, and I ask this as a question, but was it as fun to write as it was for us to read?
Well, at times it was, you know. I mean, it's a bit of soul searching, and I tried to own up to the mistakes I made. And I think one of the rules I've always tried to live by is I don't mind making a mistake. I mean, we all do. I just didn't want to make the same one twice or, you know, more than once in acting and in life. And so I tried to own up to all of the errors and the, you know, the holes that I fell into and walls that I ran into. So both as an actor and as a person. And so that was kind of hard, but it was almost, I'm not Catholic, but it was almost like going to confession. Cause once you've owned up to it, it sort of lets go of you, you know? I mean, those errors.
When you look at it as in a confessional sense, is there some cleansing, if you will, after you've told the story and sort of worked through the stuff?
Yes. Often in retrospect, but sometimes right at the moment, you realize what the lesson was of that error and that mistake, you know, whether it was the time I was cheating on a girlfriend that I dearly loved and lost the relationship because of that, you know, that's one of those that hits you right in the face. You go, boy, I really screwed this up. And to the point of where I was acting like a super important actor in my, you know, my head, my character is everything, and asking everybody on Bonanza to call me by my character name instead of my actor name. And, you know, I realized I was being a little bit of a, you know, an idiot.
I mean, you start this off in the book, and I didn't realize this until I was reading the story of how far your career goes back, but you started in, were one of the kids in Leave It to Beaver. That's an amazing credit. And you also talk about the other shows of that time and just what it was like to sort of be in that club of actors who were working on those programs.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, that's where I learned from guys like Jerry Mathers, you know, and there were awfully good directors on those shows too, that knew enough to, I looked at one of them recently, a scene we had at the beginning of an episode, and it was a lot of dialogue and it was just a lot of kids talking, and it could have been very boring, but he just said, why don't you guys play a game along this curb, and Tim, you'll lead, and if you step off the curb, they have to step off. When you step off, then you go back up, and it's like just some game he made up so that we were concentrating on that while we were doing all this dialogue. And it made the scene a very interesting scene. It was all done in one take. And it was, I thought, well, that's so smart. And because then you don't let the kids stand there and act. You just being kids, you know? And so it was really good direction. And it was a good lesson to learn, you know, as a fledgling director.
And your childhood was not idyllic in the sense of, your parents were at odds most of the time. So who was really leading the charge as to your career? And maybe you didn't even realize that's what it was at the time, but of getting you the gigs and keeping you ultimately in front of a camera.
Well, you know, I sought out being in the movies or being in TV as a sort of an escape from the broken marriage that my parents had, and I kept looking for a happy ending that they were going to get back together, and it just didn't happen. And so I sought sort of solace in pretending to be somebody else, and I could let go of all the feelings that I had being around my mother and, you know, her hardships raising two kids alone. And I've never felt more comfortable than when I'm on a set, surrounded by, you know, some 80 to 100 people whose only interest is in making a good show and helping everyone else. It's a family unto itself. And so I was looking for that family, and luckily I found that on a movie set.
I mean, obviously there have been horror stories as to children actors, but it seems as though the situations that you were in, that it, they were very, I mean, not all, but most quite positive for you as to getting to the next rung on the ladder.
Yes, I think the luckiest thing about my youthful career was I wasn't that successful. I used to kid, I kidded around and said I was the third kid through the door. There was Beaver, he
Right.
was first, and then Beaver's best buddy, he was second, and then me, you know, like yeah, Beef. I had one line or two lines, you know, and because the problem with being a kid star was they didn't have the emotional maturity to handle it when it came to an end, you know. If the show got canceled, Jerry Mather certainly, you know, he was quite the star. But there were a lot of them that once that they outgrew that age of being a kid star, what do you do? How do you transition? You know, and the ones that were smart, like Kurt Russell and Jodie Foster, Kurt became a, you know, semi-pro baseball player. He started another life, and Jodie went to college, you know. So they shifted gears, and that's what I tried to do. Sort of every 7 years, I came to a junction that I had to like find another direction. I went into voice work and spent 3 years doing that, and then I went under contract to Universal after that period, and was in Westerns for about 7 years, you know. So I was fortunate enough to find those junctions that I could, you know, take a turn at and restart my career.
Tim Matheson is our guest. The name of the new book is Damn Glad to Meet You, My 7 Decades in the Hollywood Trenches. It is interesting. I think of you, I hope you find this to be flattering. Like I don't think of you as being in your 70s. I certainly don't think of you. So when you talk about writing, it's because you've been in the business for so long. But when
Yes.
you write about working with Lucille Ball, I think of that as being a completely different generation, and yet you're there.
Yeah. I think I would, because I was so young, I was like 17 when I worked with Lucille Ball. And she was from the golden age of movies, and we started in vaudeville where they did 3 to 5 shows a day, which was a tough world, you know. And I think the lesson that she taught me, number one, was just how hard she worked to find the humor in a scene in physical comedy, how she honed it, and she worked it and worked it and worked it. And it's a tough business. She liked, we had some, you know, non-comedic scenes, very sort of emotional, personal scenes together in the movie, in Yours, Mine, and Ours. And I think she loved, you know, the way I did those scenes, but she also, I think, was trying to tell me, because she sort of was a mentor to me. It was just that it's a tough business, and you've got to toughen up to be able to protect yourself so that you don't go into the dumps when you have a bad day or a bad show or anything. You just, you know, you some days you hit a home run, some days you strike out 3 times. So that's just, that's sports, that's showbiz. Get on with it.
You were Johnny Quest.
I lucked out. There was another transition. I had come to the end of my sort of kid acting days. You know, I sort of like it was a gawky teenager, and I got one of 10 auditions that week to go into Hanna-Barbera, which was one of my favorite the only people who made cartoons for TV at that point, really. And I mean, Joe Barbera had me audition for this adventure series they were going to do called Johnny Quest. And I did it, and I didn't hear anything for 3 months. I figured it's done. I didn't get it, whatever. And then I got a call one day saying, "Hey, yeah, we're going to do this, and you're Johnny." And I got to tell you, I worked with Mel Blanc and Don Messick and June Foray and Jana
Yeah.
Waldo, all these people who did the Flintstones, and you know, Mel Blanc did all the Looney Tune voices over at Warner Brothers, and Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck, and so they were tremendous actors, and so I learned a whole new set of skills working with them, and finding out there was in a whole other part of show business rather than Leave It to Beaver and My Three Sons, or just being on camera, the behind the camera on voice was really a whole other career.
What was it like to just be in a room with that talent of someone? I mean, June Foray, of course, was Rocky,
Yep.
and Mel Blanc, you mentioned, as Daffy Duck, and every man of a thousand voices, and did
Right.
everything. Barney Rubble, and the list goes on and on. Don Messick, who was it was Scooby-Doo, and so forth. So I think if I'm a kid and I'm a teenager and I'm sitting there with these people, I'm like, oh, you know, do Astro, right? I would. That would be me.
Well, they were, I mean, they were doing, I mean, he was, they were doing so many things. I was in awe of them because it was the professionalism that, I mean, Mel Blanc could create a new voice for an animal, a dog, a cat on the spot, and
Yeah.
give it a personality that fit the story. And it was like, oh my God, I mean, how did they do this? It was beyond belief.
So here's a guy, Mel Blanc, who started in radio, was one of the stars of the Jack Benny Show.
Yes.
Are you inquisitive about that, or being a young person that you're just worried about the gig at hand?
Well, I think I was probably more concerned with the gig at hand. Though when I did work with Mel, I got to know him better, and I could talk to him about, those days when what's it like doing Bugs Bunny and all those voices, and he was very generous with me. But I tried not to be a fanboy when I was there, and there wasn't enough time because
Right.
basically you'd come in, you'd sit down, you'd read through the script, then you'd get up in front of eight microphones that faced a big window that, the control room was behind, and Joe Barbera was the director, and we'd do a take. And it was like doing a live play, it was like doing a radio play. We'd all stand at our mics and act the whole show, and then maybe pick up a few lines at the end if they wanted to redo something. But it was great working with them. They were wonderful actors, one and all of them.
You mentioned about the various stages of your career, but working a lot in Westerns, which is part of the time of just what was popular at that period, right?
Yes. They were, from Gunsmoke to High Chaparral, Laramie, and the Virginian Bonanza. It was chock full of Westerns, and they slowly kind of receded away from popular television.
Tim Matheson is our guest. The name of the new book is Damn Glad to Meet You, My 7 Decades in the Hollywood Trenches. At what point did you realize as a teenager, was it always, okay, this is what I want to do with my life, that I want this to be my profession?
Well, I'm one of those lucky kids that's all I wanted to do, even as a
Right.
kid, and but like any actor, freelance actor, every job you could very well be your last job. You don't know what's going to happen. And as I recounted in the book, there was, the best and worst day of my life as a young actor was one day that I had a horrible audition for a pilot for a series that never sold, and I was getting lectured by this other actor who wasn't very talented about how I should play every line and audition with him. And then I walked into a meeting and found Kurt Russell in the same meeting, and we were both offered to star in a series together called The Quest for Columbia TV. And it was like, so from this horrible audition to being offered, and I had never been offered anything at that point, to being offered a, you know, the lead in a series alongside Kurt, who was a, you know, a big star. I was like, okay, that's quite the day, I must say.
You're working in LA. You're in an improv troupe called the Groundlings, world famous, of course. And you're working there, and this is when you first get the script for Animal House. You immediately fall in love with this. I mean, this is something that becomes just the big star on the radar of, this is what I have to do.
Yes. Yes. And I, of course, I met with a casting person, the casting director. Then they allowed me to interview with the director, and we had a nice meeting. And then I got word back from my agent. They said, no, they don't think you're right. You're a cowboy or a surfer because you got long hair, and you're not preppy. You're not going to get the part. You can't even audition. And I was just crestfallen. I was just destroyed. And I just thought, oh my God, my career's, I'm just going to be playing these nice guy parts for the rest of my life. And it's like, I want to break out of it. And I'd been studying improv. So I begged to get an audition and wheedled an audition out of them. And I figured, even if I go down in flames, I'll at least had a shot. I got to bat. And it turned out I auditioned with Peter Riegert, who was also an improv actor. And we used the script as a point of departure. And we improvised that. We did the scene in the script, but then elaborated on it with our improv, and he bounced off me and I bounced off him. And we had them in stitches. John Landis and Doug Kenny and Ivan Reitman were just laughing their asses off. And they called me back the next day, and I came back and we did it again. And they thought it was funny. And then John Landis took me outside in the hall and said, we're going to hire you. You're going to be Otter. We love you. We want you in this picture. And he said, and don't tell anybody about that I said this. And so immediately I called my agent and I said, don't say anything, but I think we're going to get the part.
But then you had to go, you had one more hurdle, and that was Chevy Chase.
Yeah. There's always one more, you know, it's never easy. I mean, the studio hated the movie. They were trying to do anything they could to help it, as they, in their vernacular, you know, they wanted to have two stars, John Belushi and Chevy, maybe because of Saturday Night Live. But John Landis, the director, only wanted real actors around John Belushi because he felt it grounded the humor and it would make it better and real. He didn't want a sketch from Saturday Night Live where they're sort of winking at the audience, you know, and knowing it's funny. So he took Chevy out to lunch and said, I know you're being offered this other movie with Goldie Hawn, but why would you do that movie where they're going to pay you $2 million and you get to star with Goldie Hawn in a romantic comedy when you could come up to Eugene, Oregon and be one of the 10 guys in our fraternity alongside your pal Belushi, who's got a better part. And, you know, and you don't have to work that hard. And unfortunately, we don't have very much money to pay you. So by the end of lunch, Chevy's going, I'm going to do the Goldie movie. He talked him out of it.
So you get the part, and you're doing this. So I mean, you obviously address this in the book, but I assume you're asked more about Animal House than anything else. I assume you're asked about working with John Belushi more than anything else. I will say that your stories about Belushi are very, I mean, they're great and they're fascinating and they're funny. But there's almost a reverence there, isn't there?
Oh, he was, you know, we didn't know what to expect. The Deltas all came up a week before we started shooting, sort of called rehearsal, but we didn't really rehearse. We just hung out together and got to know each other and got each other's vibe. And we rehearsed, we played around with our characters. And then Belushi showed up, and we didn't know what to expect, whether this is going to be a snooty guy who thinks he's next to God because he's in this amazing hit on TV, Saturday Night Live, which was in its second year. And he couldn't have been nicer, couldn't have been more gracious. He wasn't a star from New York. He was an improv actor from Second City in Chicago. And an improv actor invites everybody in and says, yes, and, you know, so if you say, look, there's a wall, you know, and it, yeah, wow, and it's tall, how are we going to get over it? Here's a ladder. You know, I mean, you build on whatever you get. And that was John Belushi. And since it was my first comedy, he knew that he supported me, and he'd always give me a look after a good take. And he, you know, encourage me and laugh at stuff we did. And he just couldn't have been kinder and more generous.
I think it is. And in speaking with many actors, it's they'll tell you, I mean, you talked about this, you say in the book, I mean, this is one of the best scripts you'd ever until West Wing, that this is the best script you ever read. But that doesn't always mean it's going to be a great movie. This turned out also to be a great movie.
Yeah. And that's because of I think John Landis and Ivan Reitman worked together. And, you know, Ivan went on to, after this picture, he got no love or respect for producing this movie. And he did a lot. He helped this movie a lot because the studio hated it. And Ivan would work around them and get what John Landis needed. So he went off and did Meatballs and Stripes and Ghostbusters, you know, I mean, so it was one of those things that it was a comedy by young people for young people. And it changed sort of the arc of American cinema, of comedy in American cinema, because of those guys, Ivan and John and Harold Ramis and John Hughes.
Yeah, John Hughes. What was that working with him? Did you have any sense of what level of genius that would become?
Only in retrospect, you know, that's where the book started, really, was I was looking back and thinking, the alchemy of Harold Ramis and Doug Kenny and Ivan Reitman and John Landis. I mean, these, and then Hughes was a Lampoon writer that Harold and brought in later to write, you know, Vacation and directed. It was a magical moment, the way the four of them sort of all, you know, influenced each other and influenced comedy in cinema. So I started the book to write about that. And then the publisher said, no, listen, you worked with Jackie Gleason and Lucille Ball and Hank Fonda and Clint Eastwood. Let's draw that into it as well. So it kind of expanded, and it basically was the lessons I learned from these greats.
You talk about lessons you learn. Here's a lesson I learned in reading the book, because I had no idea, but you're in Animal House. It's one of the, I mean, look at it as one of the great comedies of all time. It's an iconic film. It's a classic film. It's hilariously funny. It has aged well, and it is just a part of our lexicon. So then you come out of this and you're Otter, man, and you're on the top of the world. So the next job is the Apple Dumpling Gang Rides Again.
I needed a gig. I got paid nothing for Animal House. None of us did. I think Belushi got more than anybody, but Donald Sutherland did okay. But he turned down points in the movie to get cash, which cost him ultimately, I don't know, $20 million in the long run. But yeah, you know, I was a working actor, and I had house payments and stuff. And so when Disney offered me the Apple Dumpling Gang, I said, I got to work. It was not
that working with Tim Conway or Don Knotts would be a bad thing. I mean, they're legends themselves.
No, absolutely. But it was the old style of comedy versus the new style of comedy. And it was, you know, my agent said, it's not going to hurt you. And I said, okay. I need the dough. What else can I do? You know?
So then it starts to get you meetings, and it starts to meeting Animal House starts to get you meetings, starts to get you offers, and things get better. At what point do you start to feel that the career is working in a trajectory that you're happy with?
When Steven Spielberg called me up, I was on my way back from Apple Dumpling Gang. I had driven my car to Utah where we were shooting it. And I stopped in Las Vegas to spend the night and, you know, play a little craps. And I had dinner and then went to bed. And the phone rings in my room early in the morning. And I don't know how anybody found me. I didn't tell anybody where I was. All of a sudden, we have Steven Spielberg on the line for you. And I went, okay. And Steven, grabs the phone and he says, oh, I loved you in Animals. I just love you. I'm doing this comedy, this big comedy movie, and I'd love you to be in it. Belushi's going to do it. And I have two parts in it that I'd love you to play. And you can take either one of them, whichever one you want to play, you can do. And I thought, wow. He had just done Close Encounters, prior to that Jaws, and Duel and Sugarland Express before that. And it's, here's like the hottest director in Hollywood. And I thought, okay, this is going in the direction that I'd like it to go in. And, I don't think that movie turned out quite to be what everybody wanted it to be. That's the thing about Spielberg, is so great. He takes on a new challenge every time he makes a movie. And right. This was his sort of mad world. It was a kind of a huge Hollywood comedy was what he wanted to make. And I don't know if that was, it didn't turn out exactly like he'd hoped, I guess, or any of us had hoped. But it also cost me another job that I wanted to do, which was Airplane. I had been offered the part in Airplane. And what happened was, 1941 kept shooting past its end date, and I wasn't available in time to do Airplane, so I couldn't do it. Sadly, I had to turn it down, and that was a chance to do another fresh, innovative, outrageous comedy that also changed the face of cinema and comedy in America.
Tim Matheson is the author of Damn Glad to Meet You, My 7 Decades in the Hollywood Trenches. The book is out now from Hachette. Tim Matheson, what a delight to speak with you. Thank you so much for being with us and for sharing with us this morning.
Joe, thank you very much. Great talking to you.
Tim Matheson's new memoir, once again, is Damn Glad to Meet You, My 7 Decades in the Hollywood Trenches. It is published by Hachette. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LeDuc. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.